we're continuing in our summer series, Instruments of Peace, using St. Francis's prayer as our framework. And today we're exploring hope. So as you hear this passage from John 5, consider that as the background in the theme, hope.
And this, there was a Jewish festival, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate in the north city wall, is a pool with the Aramaic name Bethesda. It had five covered porches and a crowd of people who were sick, blind, lame, and paralyzed sat there. A certain man was there who had been sick for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there, knowing that he had already been there a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I don't have anyone who can put me in the water when it is stirred up. When I'm trying to get to it, someone else has gotten in ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." Immediately the man was well, and he picked up his mat and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath. The Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It's the Sabbath, you aren't allowed to carry your mat." He answered, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" They inquired, "Who is this man who said to you, 'Pick it up and walk'?" The man who had been cured didn't know who he was, because Jesus had slipped away from the crowd gathered there.
This week there was a really special baseball game. You'll have to humor me for a minute, okay? It happened in Alabama. It was a game between the Major League Baseball Giants and Cardinals, and it was played at Rickwood Field in Birmingham, Alabama. It was significant. Did anyone catch this game?
Yeah,
part of it? Yeah. It was significant for several reasons. Not only last month did Major League Baseball and, like, there's a reason Major League Baseball isn't, like, the most popular sport in America, because it's kind of stodgy, it's very stat-driven, it's kind of conservative. There's a whole massive unwritten rule book. But they merged in the last month. They merged Negro League baseball stats and records for more than 2,300 players with the Major League stat book. And this kind of, like, happened overnight. And when it happened, it displaced Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb for all-time stat leaders in slugging and batting average. Josh Gibson is now the leader in those stats. Huge. That's pretty huge, right? So that happened in the last month. Also, in the last week, Willie Mays passed away. And in the same week, we as a nation celebrated Juneteenth, the Independence Day for American enslaved folks, where their liberation became actualized in Galveston, Texas, following the end of the Civil War. So all this is happening, and they play a game. The next slide has what it looked like at this renewed and restored Rickwood Field in Birmingham, Alabama, where the Birmingham Black Barons played their games, known as the country's oldest ballpark. The two teams that played there, each franchise has deep Negro League ties in their city, and they spotlit all these aged former players, some for the first time. They interviewed this guy, Bill Grayson, who has to have the most, like, Forrest Gump-like life resume I've ever seen. Did anyone see this guy? He's 99 years old. He's the oldest living Negro League player. He grew up across the street from Martin Luther King Jr. He served in the military and took part in the Battle of Iwo Jima. And then he served 53 years as a pastor of Bethel Baptist Church. Like, whoa, right? That guy. So the coverage of this was amazing. The game was great, and all of this seemed like pure joy and pure hope. Until they interviewed former Oakland A and Yankee great Reggie Jackson. Reggie is known as Mr. October, and they asked him, what it was like to return to Rickwood, which is where his major league career started, and what it was like to witness this celebration. And he hesitated a bit. Normally you don't get real answers to these questions on live television. But he started to go into what he did experience. The racism he experienced in that place, the way some of his white teammates stood up for him. The team tried to eat at a country club and they didn't want to serve him specifically, and so his whole team got up and left. He talked about his fear of playing baseball just about 3 or so years after some kids were firebombed in a black church just down the road in Birmingham. He talked about the ways that racial violence and terror hung over and haunted that place, even as all the beautiful things were happening that night. He described this desperate and traumatic experience in this place. And it was really marked like counter experience to the hope and the joy that was present in the redemption that was being put on display. Like they redeemed that place. Even just they described the ways they architecturally redeemed it. They brought it up to code and they shifted it about 3 degrees in one direction to make it square and regulation. And there was a lot of healing on display, but Reggie's experience was there in the midst of that hope and healing. How could these things exist all in the same place? How can hope and healing overtake so much hurt? Is that even possible? Those were questions that I had as I watched him answer A-Rod's seemingly innocuous question. Moving from kind of the inside baseball of that experience to John's gospel, we find a desperate situation couched inside of a special place during a time of great celebration. Jerusalem was the place to be for these regular feast days, these celebrations and reenactments of God's saving acts. We're told this is festival season, likely the Passover festival, the remembrance of God's deliverance of God's people from Egypt, slavery, sin, and death. The ruins of these pools, this special place, still stand today. Beside these elaborate pools, think like ceremonial sacred places, not like the YMCA during a heat wave, you know. Beside these pools gathered all of these people looking for their lives to be changed. It says, sick, blind, lame, paralyzed. Beside these pools, desperate to participate, but in some way disabled from participating with God's people. They were on the outside, waiting indefinitely to be part of what God was doing, what God might do. Then the story zooms in on this one guy in particular. He had been waiting for 38 years. Can you imagine that? 38. It's hard for me to imagine like returning to one place over and over for essentially my whole lifetime, hoping for one thing. I don't know, maybe we don't know that he was hoping for one. We don't really even know what he was hoping for. I wonder if he really even hoped anymore, or if that was just the only place he could be. I wonder if he was showing up out of like faithfulness and hope, or showing up out of desperation, or if that even matters that much. The other night at our Oak Guys hangout, the group text is called Oak Bros, but it's not that bro-y, I promise. We sat around a fire and we talked about hope and despair and some of the differences. How hope differs from just optimism. Optimism is just thinking things are gonna somehow get better. But hope has an aim. Hope has a goal. Hope has an end, a focus. Optimism just is. Not everyone can even be optimistic, but for those of us who can, sometimes optimism, though, can be the most upsetting or damaging when we're disappointed. Nazi concentration camp survivor Viktor Frankl tells of the deaths of despair that surrounded him in the camps, specifically his friend Felix. You see, Felix had this dream that he could wish for anything, and what he wished to know was the day that he would be liberated, that he would be saved, that someone would break in and this long nightmare would be over. And Felix heard a voice, and the voice said, March 30th. So March 30th, yeah. So Felix was oriented towards that goal. Rach always says, I can do anything if I have an end point, you know? And as that date approached and nothing seemed to change, as there was no real signs that hope was going to be realized, Felix's health started to decline. He started to despair. When March 30th came and when March 30th went, he plunged deeply into despair, and Felix died on March 31st. His body physically shut down from the disappointment that he had experienced. Frankl writes, "It is a peculiarity of man that he can only live by looking to the future, and Felix no longer had a future. There was a false horizon. He had no future, so he had no life." Another World War II POW turned now preeminent theologian of hope and recently passed, Jürgen Moltmann, he reiterates that totally without hope one cannot live. He says, to live without hope is to cease to live. Hell is hopelessness. Jesus asks this man that he finds in this place bluntly, and I think it's a question so simple it might be insulting, or it's so incisive, I wonder if he had to hesitate for a second to form an answer. He says to the man, do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? I think this was a question about the man's hope, what he desired. It was a challenge for him to put into words what he was actually hoping for. It's a question of whether he still had hope at all or whether he was just going through desperate motions. We might ask ourselves that too. What do we want? And do, in the places where we're hurting, do we want to get well? Was this man even hoping that might happen? Was he even hoping to get well? And his answer is really fascinating. He says, he kind of doesn't answer directly. He says, sir, I don't have anyone who can put me in the water when it's stirred up. When I'm trying to get to it, someone else has always gotten ahead of me. There's a couple things happening here. First, he says, I don't have anyone. That's kind of an indirect answer to, do you want to get well? He then says, and when I do get close, I get skipped in line. Some commentators have zoomed in on the phrase, I don't have anyone, to say that he is saying, I don't have a single human person who can help me. I cannot rely on human means for my salvation and my healing. In the middle of the man's desperation and his hope, and his need and desire to get well, was his need and his desire for someone to be with him to help him get well. He was lonely, he was helperless before he was helpless. And Jesus shows up. Jesus shows up. He doesn't have anyone to help him, and Jesus shows up. I think, as we're considering in this series, how we might be in developing imaginations for what it means to be instruments of peace, how we can apply hope to despair, it is first and fundamentally about a ministry of presence, of learning how to be with, showing up and being there. Before you do anything, before you say anything, it's showing up for someone who does not have anyone to help them. It's simply being the person who can put someone in the water, so to speak. They say the best ability is availability. So too with spreading hope in God's peace. Just being available. The second thing I notice here, I love the detail about the water being stirred up. He says, I don't have anyone to help me get in the water when the water is stirred up. I can't help but hear an echo of like the Negro spirituals recounting the story of God's liberation at Exodus, where God's people would be freed by entering the waters of the Red Sea, and God would trouble those waters, making a way for them to pass through and for Pharaoh's army to be drowned out and put down. It should not be surprising that in this place, at this special time, during the remembrance and the celebration of Passover, that God was troubling new waters for liberation and healing. God is troubling new waters. God is always troubling new waters for liberation and healing and begging us to enter in trust. There's not like intense preparation for this man, although he's had 38 years of preparation. Just come to the waters. Like the waters of creation, the Spirit hovers over void and chaos to bring about beauty and goodness. Like the waters of the flood in the Noah story, God is pledging peace and a new beginning in the waters. Like the waters of Christian baptism, right here, we witness this. Jesus entering into sin and suffering and death and raising us to be his body in the world, walking in newness of life. Jesus' invitation is always to step into the waters. The waters are troubled, the waters are fine. There's no prerequisite. The waters beg us to come in. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us, and Christ is raising us to walk and work in new creation for peace. So Jesus gives just this invitation to the man. Maybe he didn't know that morning when he woke up he was going to get an invitation from Jesus. Jesus says, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. The man is met in his suffering. The man is met in his loneliness. The man is met in whatever doubt he had that anything could ever be different than the way it's been for 38 years. And just like that, he's invited to participate in something he likely never could have even known to hope for. That's the thing about hope. we're to somehow have hope even when we don't know what really we should be hoping for. Hope is general and hope is specific, and hope must always open us up to God's arrival and God's action. This man's hope, I think it was specific for him. It was specific enough to locate him in this place. He knew if anything was going to happen in his life, it was going to happen here, so he better get there. And then he kept coming back over and over and over. It allowed him to recognize and to respond to Jesus when Jesus did come. But I think his hope was also general enough that allowed him to roll with what Jesus was going to tell him, right? If he only knew or only hoped for his healing to happen in one specific way, he might not be able to respond to Jesus when Jesus says, pick up your mat and walk. Hope is like growing in an imagination for healing. That's what it means to hope, is to grow in an imagination for healing. It's to have an orientation towards a future in which things can be different. Even though things are bleak, and even though suffering now is real. So it makes me, reading back on that Rickwood Field, like to imagine what the amount or ability of hope was for those black players in the 60s. What they could even imagine, what they could even tolerate for hope that we are now starting to see, even with the memory of that hurt. this is all held together in the story of Jesus' cross and Jesus' resurrection. This is why we can have hope. Because Jesus has entered and experienced deep hopelessness and abandonment and injustice. He was betrayed and he was crucified. His religion failed him. His government failed him. The crowds and popular opinion failed him. His friends failed him. In the words of Psalm 22, even God failed and forsook him. But after suffering and dying and being buried, Holy Saturday is probably the most hopeless time in the history of the world. Have we ever thought about that? The silence and darkness of Holy Saturday. The stillness. After that, God's Spirit raised Jesus from the dead. This happened specifically to Jesus, but now generally for us and with us all. To paraphrase the psalm that we sang, Psalm 23, Jesus walks with us, ahead of us, through the valley of the shadow of death. And Jesus broke the locks on hell and death, and now the prisoners are freed. The suffering moved towards healing. The cross stands as a monument of hope, and this is now the cornerstone of our faith, that there can be hope. Moltmann says, faith sees the resurrection of Christ, not the eternity of heaven, but the future of this very earth on which the cross stands. It sees Jesus, in Jesus, the future of the very humanity for which he died. That's why it finds in the cross the hope of the world. We look at the cross and we see hope because we see the future coming into our present. We see Jesus showing us what it might mean like to pick up our mat and walk, to be healed, to walk in this world in newness of life, and in a life that is so durable, death and sin can't touch it. In the story in John, these words of Jesus kind of throw everything off balance. Jesus' resurrection throws everything off balance. It creates kind of as much instability as it does create solidity and trust in the hope that God creates and raises the dead and will never be put to shame. Jesus talks to this man. He says, pick up his mat. And this now walking man throws everything off balance. We should be prepared for this. Hope shifts our imaginations and rapidly makes our old expectations obsolete. They're too small. They're too confined. God is doing and has done something big and new. So to grow in hope means to shed the skin of our despair. It means to abandon our too small hope so we can bear and share the hope of our experience. And that's what this man does. Doesn't even know what he's really saying. He doesn't even remember Jesus's name when they ask, who told you to pick up your mat and walk? He says, I don't know, that guy who healed me, that guy. Jesus takes off. This hope and this healing is so elusive, and it's not even centered on the necessity of Jesus staying there. Jesus heals us and moves on. Jesus' hearers are scandalized that he is doing this kind of healing work on the Sabbath. They have too small of a hope, too confined of a package for what God is doing in this world, too obsolete an understanding on how this all works. All the Sabbath was ever for was healing. It was for wellness. It was to make things whole. A whole day of rest. To do the Sabbath well, to do it right, means to grow in our hope that we can get well. To grow in our hope that we can get well. To trust in God that we can stop doing and God will do for us. That the world is held and sustained by the abundance and the grace of God. By God who can and who cares. By God who also rests. That's the grace and the scandal of it all. To miss this is to be locked in this world of 1+1 and cynicism and despair that things don't add up to what we think we need. to not see the future of God's healing and to not expect God to be able to break things and fix them. God breaks into our present to give us more than we deserve, more than we can imagine, and to make us more than we already are. This is what it means to not lose hope, to learn how to do that together. It means that we can remember and remind each other that we're not alone. We can look to our left and we can look to our right and we can see people that can help us get into the water when we need healing. We can expect God to show up. We can lean on and even be a hopeful presence for others. So let's not give in to despair, even when all the evidence points towards hopelessness. Let's keep showing up. Keep looking to the cross. Keep picking up mats, our own and others. Keep hoping to get well. Y'all pray with me. Lord, make us instruments of your peace, specifically instruments of clocks and calendars, that we can anticipate forward, especially in the middle of sorrow and grief and suffering, to a time when God will intervene, will show up, will heal and comfort and renew. Let's also remember backwards with clear eyes and pure hearts to deep sorrow and suffering, and also the ways that Christ walked with us in those dark places. Help us be thankful for how far we've come and give us endurance for the journey ahead. And Lord, craft us into people of the future where our tears will be wiped away and our brokenness put back together. Let us not lose hope when things feel desperate. And let us share your grace for today and your bright hope for tomorrow. Amen.